Wolf, get away from those sheep.
Bollocks.
You're listening to the Wolf and the Shepherd podcast, broadcasting from Fort Worth in the great state of Texas. Now, get ready for this episode of the Wolf and the Shepherd.
Welcome to this episode of the Wolf and the Shepherd. Today we have with us Heather Wickman. Heather Wickman. That's, for some reason, shouldn't be that difficult to say, but right as I was saying it, I don't know, I got tongue twisted. Anyway, Heather is the author of the book, The Evolved Executive. We have that sitting right here. Heather, glad you could join us today.
Hey, I'm super excited to be here. I have a feeling it's going to be one of those interesting conversations.
I hope so, too.
So I did notice that you have the middle name Hansen. Now, were your parents big Hansen Mbop fans in the 80s? And that's how you ended up with that name?
Let's hope not. That's my maiden name.
Oh, okay.
All right. Yeah. Wow.
Close, though.
You know, yeah. Literally, as we're starting Women's History Month, you mistake that for a middle name.
Women's History Month?
It's Women's History Month.
What's that?
Did you not know that? Well, did you know that, Heather?
I did. Yeah. It popped up on my calendar.
So, all right. Yeah, so March is Women's History Month.
All right. So yes, we got official. Have we got 5 minutes sometime this month to cover that in depth?
Well, you know, in honor of Women's History Month, we're having a woman guest.
Right, okay.
They can't call us sexist.
We'll check that box off then.
Yes.
So, you know, okay.
Heather decided that she's given us permission that we are not sexist or chauvinist or any of those other male-hating terms.
Right, okay. So, Heather, along with a book, you sent us a lovely love bracelet, which we have put on Darth Vader's head over there. But I'll be honest with you, since we've put it on, he's been giving it all that and giving us a lot of crap. So I don't think love has been spreading around the office that much, has it?
No, it hasn't. It hadn't quite worked. But
right.
We do realize that he is an inanimate object.
Well,
and when you keep telling people that he talks to you, they're going to look at you a little funnier than they normally do.
Well, I like to attribute anthropomorphic qualities to inanimate objects to help myself feel loved and surrounded by people who understand me. So,
which is no one.
Nobody. So the book, The Evolved Executive, can you tell us just a little bit of background about the book and also how it relates into this love movement?
Yeah. So the book is called The Evolved Executive, The Future of Work is Love in Action. So I've got a little bit different take than most folks in terms of how we need to approach business or leadership for that matter. And, you know, we've been stuck in this kind of space of command and control for so long that my idea and my hypothesis is that when we approach it differently from a place of love and not like kumbaya love, but love that says, I care for you and we can have tough conversations and we can do this all together, we can make a better place in terms of not only the profits for the organization, but also a place for all of us to hang out. So the bracelet is the Love Is Project. And so it's a great organization that's promoting the same thing by giving women in other countries great opportunities to provide their craft.
I was specifically told at my job, my first job, that there will be no love in the office. I think that was an instruction.
I think that answers everybody. Kind of a British thing.
Yeah.
And maybe it is kind of what you're trying to look at getting rid of, right? Because we all think work is work. Work is serious. You know, you got to be serious. You can't have, you know, those relationships or anything like that. Is that kind of what you're speaking towards or maybe against would be the better term to move us into more of a relational aspect than this employer-employee aspect?
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, for most of us, we spend probably the majority of our lives at work in some way, shape, or form. And if you look at some of the statistics in that book, it's pretty tragic in terms of how toxic the work scenario, the work environment can be. And that is often because we've got these really outdated approaches of how we need to interact with one another. And similar, we're not talking love in the romantic sense, but love in the sense that I value you. I think you have things to contribute. There's a place for us to belong and to connect. Can actually be a place where not only we can grow, but we can flourish as individuals and as companies. And so, yeah, it's a different relational element.
Well, we've hit a bit of a roadblock there because some of your employees, you're not entirely sure whether they deserve love and compassion, really. We're trying to get rid of some of them, aren't we?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
So a few.
Can we just knock this entire approach down to specific employees, or does this have to be company-wide? Yeah,
the ones that actually really matter.
Yeah,
right?
The ones that matter, yeah.
No, I think about the joke that is constantly told about like upper management and everything, and saying, you know, show your appreciation to your employees and all that. And the best upper management can do is a pizza party. Right.
Yeah.
And so I don't know if that's exactly kind of in your book, but as far as that being a metaphor, what are some of the ways that an employer can actually do things better than give everybody a pizza party on Friday or have, you know, Hawaiian shirt Friday, things like that?
Yeah, those things just fall really flat. So that's the typical go-to. So how could we provide more perks, whether it be a foosball table, you know, happy hour party, something like that, pizza party, like you said, when in fact, if you look at it from a kind of a research perspective and also my own experience, the thing that draws people the most is give them an opportunity to grow.
Right.
And that, and when you look at it, I talk about several different things in the book around what it means to have love in action. And it's really about, can you create an environment for folks to grow? And that's really about how I am angling this kind of different paradigm shift in terms of how we lead organizations.
Now, obviously, as technology has evolved, the relationships within the office dynamic have evolved. I remember my first couple of office jobs, you know, we'd have regular meetings, whether it be, you know, like group team meetings or just one-on-one meetings or small group meetings. But now it seems people are happy to send out a group email, and a lot of that personal touch and I guess human nature has gone out of it, because it's hard to read inflection in an email or a text. And, you know, it's become very, I won't say bland or sterile, but I think a lot of people realized when they started working from home during the pandemic that they hadn't really lost much in terms of the psychosocial aspect of business relationships, because they could maintain almost the same type of relationship as, you know, the way business has been evolving. So how is this kind of like a form of new management style going to integrate with this move in a way almost from very personal relationships in business?
Yeah. So I would say there's kind of an interesting take on that in terms of, you know, how we relate to one another, whether it's in person, in an office setting, or virtually. We've oftentimes lost the human element, right? So we've lost understanding who you are as a person, what makes you tick, what motivates you, what inspires you, what's your family up to, what do you like to do as hobbies? And so whether it's virtual or non-virtual, those are the conversations we need to kind of come back to having. Some of the work in the book is all around like this idea that growth is a team sport. So we need to find ways to come together a little bit differently so that we can kind of have those opportunities to understand who we are and how we're going to move forward more effectively. And again, and that's by growing together. So I've done the traditional growing together thing in traditional organizations. So you do a training event and you go offsite and you do this whole conference thing. And I was a big fan of that. I did that for 15 years within corporations. And, you know, if you knew me 10 years ago, you'd never guess that today I'd be doing that with clients and entrepreneurs with sacred plant medicines and horse retreats, these type of different experiences that get us in a different mindset so that we can create new patterns and new belief systems so that we can actually do different things when we go back to work.
Do you find when you're working with these executives and things like that, that they struggle with trying to find those candidates who really need the focus of growth? The people that maybe kind of do their job really well, you kind of leave them alone, you know that this dude's going to be here, he's going to show up on time, he's going to, you know, stay the course of the day, he's going to leave on time, you know, never causes problems, all of that. And you think, well, this is the model employee. We don't need to grow him. We need to grow the problem employee over here and try to fix them rather than building up the good employee.
Yeah. I imagine there's a story on your end around that. But from what I see, that individuals or executives that I work with oftentimes have that perspective initially, like, let's leave the good performers alone and focus on the folks that we need to like really up their performance. But I challenge them to think about that a little bit differently in terms of, if you're having performance issues, have a conversation with that individual. More often than not, that person wants to leave. Something is not working. So whether it's a poor job fit, whether they have an interpersonal issue with their boss, or it's just the wrong organization or what they want to be doing altogether, where we tend to focus on the folks who are doing their job, but have aspirations and potential to really blossom within the organization. And then there's the CEOs and executives who are like, I want them all to grow. So we're going to invest in them all. And if individuals opt out of that, that probably tells me something about their fit with the culture.
Now, how do you approach businesses which are very resistant to, I guess, giving their employees this freedom to explore their own type of work ethic and approach to project management? Because traditionally, you know, there's always been this division between the people who work and the bosses above, like, you know, the man, stick it to the man and all this type of stuff. And I think it's been exemplified as, you know, the technological age has come in, because people are able to do research on companies. And whereas before there was a kind of not necessarily healthy skepticism that businesses were all about profit and they don't care about the employees. But now we're bombarded with so many examples of that, that I think the average employee, you know, doesn't feel that there's probably any loyalty from the company they work for. It's more about what they can provide to the company. So how do you kind of overcome that barrier and get rid of that skepticism and, you know, convince people that, look, this is actually going to be a little bit different. We actually genuinely want you to grow. This isn't going to be another one of these 2-week programs, which then nobody talks about, but we can check it off the box at your PR meeting that, you know, you had some, you know, in interaction with your bosses and that's it for the next 48 weeks.
Yeah. So the short answer is, executives who don't actually care about growing don't tend to work with me. So I don't have to deal with that a lot, but I will speak to the skepticism, because that's even there when an executive truly wants their organization or their team specifically to grow. And frankly, it takes time, like, because it's a trust barrier. So just like a relationship that you have with a friend, the skepticism might not be as high, but there could be some baggage there. So you really have to work with that executive to create consistency in what they're doing, what they're saying, and what they believe in, to allow those employees to kind of come along. And it's, you know, that kind of model and reinforce idea. So what is it that you're trying to change? And that individual usually has to go through a growth experience themselves first to prove that it's valid, that it's worthwhile, and that they can do something different on the back end.
So there's a what I call a myth in the working industry right now, that people do not leave their jobs for more money. People leave their jobs because of poor management.
Yes.
So can you kind of speak to that? Is that really true? You know, is that really why most people are leaving their jobs?
Yeah. So management being number one and a sense of fulfillment being number two. So folks will even take less pay to work for someone that they enjoy working for, or to work for a company that they better align with, that's more fulfilling.
I want to go on the record and say I would never be one of those people that would leave for less pay. just so we're clear. Yeah.
But it's a pretty compelling statistic. So yeah, I think leaders have to take a really good look in the mirror when they start having a lot of people leave. So right now we've got kind of this great resignation going on. And yeah, there's some dynamics in the workforce because of COVID and all of these kind of things, but also because individuals are realizing, hey, there's a lot more options now when I can work basically at home for anyone. And so leaders have to work a little bit harder to ensure that they're creating an environment where actually people want to work with them.
You brought up the great resignation. Let's speak a little bit about that. What exactly is going on with that? We hear that term thrown around so much, the great resignation. Can you kind of give us the 30,000 foot view on that?
Yeah, my sense of it is that because of the shakeup in terms of what COVID created, so the shutdown and then everyone coming back virtually kind of shifted the nature of how we work. So I can literally be here in Colorado and work for a company somewhere in Europe and really have no sense of it being any different than if I lived there. And so we've got so many more opportunities in front of us that people are not only looking at it differently in terms of who do I want to work for, what's most important in my life, and maybe I don't want to work as much anymore. So I think it's been this time of people taking this huge reflection of like, do I actually care to be where I'm at, working for who I'm working for, and making some pretty drastic decisions to do things differently.
And so going along with that, with this great resignation happening, what can the employers and the executives do to prevent that mass exodus?
Yeah. Create an environment for people to flourish, i.e. create an environment for people to continue to grow in the ways that are fulfilling and meaningful for them.
So, you know, we touched upon, you know, skepticism of some employees and some resistance, perhaps even from some levels of management, especially people in middle management, because those are the ones who are always looking over their shoulder at the next people coming up. How do you kind of combat reluctance in people who genuinely aren't that social? If you go back to that old movie Office Space, the dude who just wanted to be left alone and, you know, started going a bit crazy when people started messing with his day-to-day routine. But you have plenty of people who go to work to get a paycheck and they're not interested in the social dynamics of the office or invest in a long-term future, because many people do just use various employments as a stopgap. You know, I'm going to be here for 2 years and move on to something I really want to do, or this is just literally bringing in a paycheck and I hate it. So, you know, I guess bringing in the whole love attribute into this approach, how do you make those people, or try and influence those people, to see that this is a good thing to form dynamic relationships within the workplace and have a mutual support system rather than this kind of lone wolf approach to work?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and there's no real easy answer to that. From the perspective of, like, you can't change really another person. You can help them see a different way. You can give them pretty much everything to create a shift. But at the end of the day, if they want to be the lone wolf, they're going to be the lone wolf. And so, like I said before, the love and action concept isn't this idea of it's all going to be great and butterflies and wonderful conversations. This could be a situation of really kind of a tough love scenario of, we are trying to create an environment or a culture where everyone is coming together as a team player. And that requires that you, you know, be collaborative, that you participate, that you join in team calls, whatever it might be, to help that individual see what it's going to take to be a part of this team. And so it kind of comes back to, what is that CEO or executive trying to create? And maybe it's okay that that individual is the lone wolf and they're going to do what they're going to do. They're going to come in for a paycheck and then they're going to, you know, kind of check out. But if they're trying to create something different, then a tough love conversation is probably the thing that's going to happen there to see if that individual is a fit going forward.
So, sorry, how would you, with example of Max here, right? He has quite a few people underneath him in various states and also within here in Texas. And he knows which staff are kind of performing, you know, I guess, to their expectations, which ones underperform. And any boss at the top, I guess, not necessarily has a hit list, but, you know, they're pretty well informed in terms of productivity of their staff. Do you find that sometimes the approach from the top might be, well, I don't want to do this because I know right from the get-go that, you know, people aren't just going to take this. A lot of these people are just doing their jobs, just running through this. You know, how do you convince somebody that it's worth taking the risk to maybe make a change and that might actually change that dynamic within the organization?
Yeah. It usually takes a crisis. And I know that sounds a little tough, but this idea of the great resignation puts a mirror in front of a lot of executives that says, okay, I need to do something different if I want to retain staff or hire the best performing staff. In a situation like you're describing, where you kind of have an idea of, you know, there's some good players and there's maybe some not as good players. You can continue to go the path that you're going and saying, I'm going to do what I've done in the past. It's worked, and it's going to work until it doesn't. And so when it no longer works is the time in which usually I end up working with individuals because they are ready to do something different. So I tend not to try to talk people into it, because this whole idea of, you know, we're going to be in this collaborative, participative, caring environment usually isn't your first go-to. It's usually based on something's not working, so I have to do it differently.
It's kind of interesting that just prior to that, you bring up basically what you would call the introvert, right? And trying to talk about that tough love and you know, you were talking about that lone wolf aspect, right? That person that wants to kind of sit in the background, do their job, collect their paycheck, pay their bills and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But it was also kind of interesting when you were saying, hey, well, you got to show them some tough love or whatever. Is there a way to bring those kind of introverts back into not necessarily being an extrovert by any means, but the remote stuff, the work from home, all that has been a blessing, I'm sure, to most introverts.
Right.
But then getting that executive to encourage them, to incentivize them, has probably been a little bit more of a struggle because the introvert can now essentially hide. You know, let's be honest, they can hide. So what should executives do on that part?
Run a fight club.
Other than that, but okay. Those are fun.
Well, that's the first
yes. stop.
Try Fight Club, then go to Heather Wickman's
yes.
approach. All right.
Yeah, so if the Fight Club doesn't work, those are situations that you kind of have to understand what's going on for that individual. So I've seen several of those kind of introvert type scenarios really shift when someone gets excited. You know, someone gets excited about the work that they're doing, a new project, working with a new colleague, whatever it might be. And so if you are in a situation where you have an introvert that is a high producer, a high potential within your team, and you want to find ways to engage them, you have to find out what excites them. What would actually get them excited to show up differently? And it might just be that they have like massive social awkwardness that makes them shut down because they feel judged and all these kind of different things. But you have to understand, like, what is going on? Like, how can I get you more excited, inspired about the work that you're doing? Because this is what I want to see on the other side. This is actually what I see your potential on the other side.
Right. Now, I read little snippets of your book, and obviously there's a big concentration on the three big, you know, business buzzwords when we talk about, you know, overall in a business, overall in a corporate identity of, you know, growth, love, change. But how is your approach with those three key things different to a lot of the models which have been coming across over the last, I guess, couple of decades, where every few years there's a new revolutionary approach to change or growth in business? And, you know, we're not going to concentrate on profits. We're going to focus on the growth of the individual. But these things become, I guess, almost cyclic. And like every 20, 30 years, they reinvent themselves and come out with a different label. But how is your approach different to perhaps some of the other approaches which have said that, oh, yeah, we're all about growth, love and change?
Yeah, it gets a little bit monotonous in terms of that cycle. What I would say is what we're doing is not something that's like radically new, but we're doing it in a way that makes more sense and gets better results. And so this whole idea of a growth culture, so that you begin weaving in growth into everything you're doing. And I'm not speaking necessarily weaving in growth of the business, because what we're seeing is when you allow individuals to grow and to do the things that they're most passionate and exceptional at doing, it automatically grows the business. But what we do differently is we move individuals and teams through what we call the growth formula. And so we've combined an understanding of how we actually move through change with peak growth experiences. And so like a little bit of background is that you can't try to help people change without teaching them actually how to change. So has anyone ever taught you guys how to actually change?
No. I don't think they'd have any luck with that.
No.
We're pretty much set in our ways. We're grumpy old men.
We take the approach to change like a rock, as in we're involuntarily eroded by society. But it wasn't a willing participant in
whatever.
Who's
this we? Do you have a mouse in your pocket? I mean, I'm the same person I was back in the 90s.
Well, that's what I'm talking about.
So you know,
the only change is erosion, not actual
ironically, shift. Heather, I forgot we were talking today when I chose my wardrobe. And he's like, oh, it's about this love and action. I'm like, I'm sure Heather will like my I Hate Real Big Fish t-shirt that I'm wearing right now, because we're literally supposed to be talking about love. And as a joke, this band put this t-shirt out back in the 90s. And I'm proud to say that I've had this since the 90s and it still fits. And I still wear it because changed.
He hasn't ironed it since the 90s either, if you can tell. Yeah,
you don't iron t-shirts. What is wrong with you?
Well, you do. They've got creases in them. Really shake them. Look at that.
There. That's better.
Right.
But anyway, I mean, there are people that do not change. I mean, there's that joke about, you know, the middle-aged man or whatever. It's like at one point, men just like stop and say, okay, this is the clothes I'm wearing for the rest of my life. I'm never going to change my outfit. I'm always going to wear a black hat and a black t-shirt, or I'm always going to wear jeans and cowboy boots and all of that. I mean, there can't always be change. I mean, some people are set in their ways.
Absolutely. The question more is like, have you been taught to change? And that's what we find for most executives, like no one has taught them how to actually move through change if they want to change. If you want the same wardrobe today until the day you die, fantastic. But it's more around if you actually want to change, most people don't know how to. And so that's kind of where we start. And then we couple it with a peak experience. So we find that unless you can kind of shake up the, what I'll call our neural network, the way in which we've done everything in the past, it's really hard to ingrain a lasting change. And so this is where we work with some different modalities to help people move through change. So we work with horses, so equine facilitated coaching, and we work with sacred plant medicine to really help people see things different and to create a new experience within their being, so that once they understand how to change, they've had a potent enough experience to set into motion a new change of behavior.
Right. So when we talk about change, people are always going to be, well, if my way's working, why do I need to change? I mean, that's always going to be the first and foremost thing. And even if there are some perceived benefits or guaranteed benefits at the end of it, people want to remain within a comfort zone if it's working for them. And it doesn't mean that they reject the ideas of growth and love and, you know, all these other things within a company. It's just, you know, if it's not going to affect me directly in my job, why should I make that change and perhaps risk diluting what I do in terms of quality or forming relationships which are going to be very temporary or I'm not really that interested in? So how does that work? How do you kind of push that word as a positive? Because a lot of people eye roll the moment you say the word change. How do you kind of convince people change is going to be a good thing?
Yeah, but at the same time, those people like you're talking about, right? It works for them, but it doesn't work for the so-called collective good of the company. So isn't it kind of incumbent upon the executive or whatever to show them why that change would be better?
Yeah, and begin modeling that change. So more often than not, we find that the resistance happens because the employees...
No, he's being distracting right now.
I was just looking at that picture of the horses there. I was
That's my next question. Yeah. So just be patient. Yeah. Let her answer the question.
Sorry.
The horses are coming.
It's Texas. All right. Whenever we drive
Texas.
When we drive past any animal, it's a Texas thing. You've got to point at the animal and say what it is.
Right. And what sound it makes.
Yeah. You've got to do that from age 5 right up to like 105. And so the moment you kind of saw the painting of the horses, I was going to be like, horses, but word rather than saying
they go nay. Yeah. So as distracting as that was, please answer that question. Yeah. And then I'm gonna ask you about the horses.
Perfect. So I think we were talking about the resistance to change. So what I find is most individuals resist change when they think that someone's making them change versus allowing them to be a part of the change. And especially when they don't see their boss, their leader, their manager doing the change. And so more often than not, we have to find ways for that individual, that executive, that leader to begin modeling the change and to help, you know, paint the story of why this change is good before anyone's really going to get on board, because the mindset is change sucks. I don't want to be a part of it. It's no good. It's just for the top executives to get more out of me, right? And it's a lot of work to try to shift that paradigm because it's got a lot of baggage in organizations.
Yeah, it's almost like the old, parent thing or it's like, because I said so, you know, or mm-hmm. do as I say and not as I do or whatever. Yeah. So you try to convince these executives to do the change and like, hey, the problem doesn't lie with me. It lies with the employees. I got to get them to change, but you got to start at the top, right?
You have to start at the top.
You got to start at the top, which leads us to the horses, you know.
The horses.
You know, yes, there's horses. Yeah. Horsey good. Horsey goes nay. Mm. Yeah. But no, I mean, of course, I mean, we're here in Texas and like everybody already knows, I mean, we ride horses every day. Everybody has at least 2 to 3 horses in their garage. We go to Whataburger and we pick up food on our horses because that stereotype is absolutely correct.
Mine's outside.
Yeah. Did you give him water, by the way?
Yeah, he's in the shade.
Oh, okay, good, good. But anyway, so let's talk about this equine coaching. I mean, I'm fascinated with it. I like horses, and all 27 of my horses would be all willing to, you know, go ahead and study this. So how does the equine coaching work?
Yeah, so the example of change is perfect. So horses, and I'm not sure if you've done kind of groundwork with your horse. They're incredible mirrors and magnifiers.
Yeah,
of
but by the way, I'm also lying to you. I don't own a horse.
You don't own a horse? Oh, God.
Look at that shot.
Well, I know. I was thinking to myself, how much farther should we take this we rode horses up here thing, you know, because Texas already looks a certain way to everybody, but yeah, I do have my cowboy boots on today though.
Mm-hmm. Well, have you ever been around horses?
Plenty of times.
And outside of a riding experience where you are riding that horse around an arena or on a trail?
Trail. Always like, you know, old school outdoor riding the horses out.
All of the above on my part.
All of the above. All right.
Yeah. You've ridden a horse in an arena.
Yeah. I grew up next to a farm, dude. I used to have to get on a horse and like move livestock.
Okay. In an arena.
Yeah. I've been in arenas. Yeah. I've warmed horses up before.
You're a barrel racer.
No, I'm not a barrel racer.
I think
I'm not pretty enough to be a barrel racer. No.
Don't believe anything he says. Arena. All the English arenas that you rode around at. Oh, you wore the little goofy hat and the tall boots.
Oh, and you mean like the Queen's Guard? Oh, yeah, the equestrians and the jumpy jump.
Yeah, stuff. Where you're jumping the little fences there.
Yeah.
Where the British people think that's what you're supposed to do. That and hunt foxes, apparently.
Yeah. That's just, yeah.
Yeah. All right. I will get back to the horses.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I'm sure that helped your train of thought there.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good. So the change scenario, like a leader trying to move their team through change is a great example of how to work with the horses. So horses are incredible mirrors and magnifiers of individuals' intentions, beliefs, and emotions. And so if you're trying to work with a horse and you are putting on a fancy face to try to get someone to do something, that horse is going to do nothing for you, if not completely act up and be a pain in the butt. And so oftentimes if I'm working with an executive who maybe has just failed pretty miserably on a change initiative and needs to learn how to lead change better, we work with a horse. Cause I always say you can lie to me as a coach, but you can't lie to this horse.
I bet I could lie to a horse.
I think I could too.
Yeah. I'd bullshit that horse all day long.
Yeah. I'm just wondering if during this training, you know, you have this executive out there, right? And you know this guy or woman is just a terrible executive. Do you ever go around to the back of the horse and point at the horse's ass and say, "This is you. This is you. You're a horse's ass."
You know, I haven't done that before.
You can have that.
You can have that one for free.
Yeah, that one's free of charge. Yeah.
Do that in the upgraded version.
Because you know she's going to do it too, don't you? I mean, well, wouldn't that be great? You know, you're an employee out there on one of these retreats. She's sitting there figuring it out. It's like, you know, the problem is actually the executive, and I've already got my check. I already cashed it. It cleared the bank. And she just goes back and says, "This is you. You're the horse's ass." Mm. And all the employees applaud, and, you know, she's signing books and everything. That's what's going to happen.
Awesome. So anytime you're in Colorado, I encourage you to come join me and we'll see if you can actually lie to a horse.
Okay. About I can lie to a horse. I'm pretty convinced in lying to a horse. Yeah. I can lie to dogs really easily. I mean, they fall for anything I say.
That's true.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But you tempt them with food all
I
the time.
I do tempt them with food, yeah. Yes.
So, yeah, you trick them.
Yeah. So, Heather, that's two kind of very different approaches. The power of the horse approach, but also the plant medicine. And you mentioned earlier about neurological changes. And, you know, as people get older, the neuroplasticity tends to not be, you know, able to absorb many things. It's like you say, you know, you can't teach an old dog new tricks. But, you know, how do you incorporate the plant medicine part? Because, you know, if you're talking something like ayahuasca, I can imagine that there are many people who are probably pretty reluctant to go down that path. But equally, I mean, psychedelics, they do open you up to a whole different realm of understanding a human nature of yourself. And also love takes on a completely different meaning when you understand that it's, you know, comprised of multiples of dozens of different factors and not just one label of love. But how is that taken when you say to somebody, okay, we're going to go on a plant medicine retreat?
So one thing I would say, in my perfect world, every CEO would have a plant medicine retreat. That'd be part of your CEO training. And, you know, the interesting thing with plant medicine is usually someone is called to it. It's a hard sell to sell someone to do plant medicine.
We're on board, aren't we? We'll go now.
Yeah.
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 Unfortunately, we're not executives. No. But
well, we are.
We just
changed it before the show started.
Yeah. And she's going to invite you out so you can go lie to horses on this plant medicine retreat. Yeah. So you get a twofer there.
Problem is, if I'm on ayahuasca, I won't lie to the horse because I'll know that I'm spiritually one with it and I'll feel it soon and just.
Are you stealing her truth. Thunder right now? No. Don't steal the guest's
it's
thunder.
Perfect. Mm. It's perfect. It's the perfect sale right there. So. Yeah, I've been working with plant medicine for the past 7 years, and it's probably done, they say, you know, a sitting with some of these powerful, like ayahuasca, is like 10 years of professional development in a traditional setting. And so it really rocket boosts one's perspective, one's growth, and one's potential when they see the world completely different. And the thing with plant medicines is it kind of shuts down your default mode network so that when you're talking about neuroplasticity, this is the monkey mind in your brain. So it kind of slows that all down so you can have really novel and incredible insights in a very short amount of time that last. So you come out of your journey and it's still there. It's not like, you know, you had this high and now you're done and it's gone. You then are doing the work of implementing that insight, but it stays with you forever. Like you kind of said, you have a different perspective of what love is. Everyone has a different perspective of what love is after they have a pretty profound experience with ayahuasca, wachuma, psilocybin, whatever it might be.
So if you were in a business building, let's say, and let's just take the COVID thing out, like back in the old days, right? And you get on an elevator and there's the CEO of a company that you want to attend one of these plant medicine retreats. What is your elevator speech to them to explain, hey, I'm Heather and here's why you need to come do this?
So I'm really going to disappoint you, but I wouldn't have an elevator pitch for that individual. I talk more executives out of doing it than doing it.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, well, we'll explain why then.
Yeah, so just give me a sense. Have either of you played with plant medicines?
A little bit.
Okay.
I had a sunburn last year, and I put aloe on it.
Aloe vera on it?
Yes. No, like literal, like aloe. Mm. Like I have an aloe plant, and I used aloe, so that counts, doesn't it?
Yeah, close enough.
Yeah.
So I would say that you have to be willing to turn your world upside down. So in the book, I say, beware, this will challenge your worldviews. And so an individual who feels called to join us with a plant medicine growth intensive has a distinct calling to experience something different in their lives or their leadership or their organization. I would never go to an executive and say, hey, I think you really should have this mind-blowing plant medicine experience because it's going to revolutionize your organization. It likely will, but there's no context for that to land, right? So there's got to be some kind of internal bubbling that says, oh, I want something to be different. You know, I feel lost. I feel no sense of purpose. I feel something's got to be there that would catapult them to say, like, hey, I heard Heather talk about this really weird thing that can kind of change their lives. I want to try that. And then I'm going to have a conversation with you.
Yeah, I think, you know, with plant medicine, it can be a difficult approach if you're completely honest about it. Because one of the things, like you mentioned in a roundabout way, was there is a death of ego that occurs pretty early on that, you know, some people find themselves uncomfortable being that vulnerable because, you know, you do approach yourself with a completely different way and it removes all of those, I won't say hateful impulses, but I guess prejudices, and you start seeing things from other people's point of view and realize where perhaps you've been overreacting, overpressuring, and, you know, you see a need for change, but then it's hard to kind of transition that once you kind of get your mind back into a regular setting and trying to convince other people that the death of the ego is a good thing when a lot of people hold on to their own ego and their own identity is the thing which is them. And so I can understand why those people don't want to change. They don't want to adopt somebody else's idea of, you know, something which is, you know, probably evolutionary, you know, what we're going to anyway, because as a species, you know, we have to be socially interactive to survive. But, you know, how do you sell plant medicine to an executive who's probably already got a pretty high view of himself and say, look, this is probably going to strip you down to your bare mental bones and you're going to have to face some hard truths, including perhaps how you may have been doing things wrong in the last decade in this business. You know, do you find that's kind of a bit of a difficult way to perhaps word, you know, how you sell this to people?
So you'd be perfect at selling it. So those are some of the exact conversations that we have. So when I said I literally talk people out of doing this, people get excited about, like, I want to have this crazy mind-blowing experience. And I'm like, oh, well, do you really? Like, do you really want to face yourself in all of your shadows and see all of the places potentially that you are sabotaging yourself? Do you want to see those things? And some people get really scared and they're like, no, I have no interest in doing that. And the other people are like, yeah, it's time for me to upgrade. It's time for me to evolve. I want to be a better person, a better leader, a better father, a better something. So yeah, I want to take a look at those things.
So almost like a be careful what you wish for kind of mentality.
And yeah. I mean, there are times on this journey that I have been, if I had to do this over, I'm not sure I would do plant medicine, because you, exactly to your earlier comment, when you come back down, integrating your new insights and new awareness of who you are as a person can be a little bit bumpy. Like, it can be hard to be like, all right, I just got insight into the 7 areas in my life where I'm sabotaging myself and being a royal ass. And now I have to do something different. I have to make different choices if I want to see a different outcome. And so it's kind of like the deep dive for leadership development. This is not your traditional, let's go to a conference room and like, pretend that we're going to be nice to each other, right? This is the deep dive that says, do you actually want to change? And if you want to change, I will be there to guide you through it and to help you integrate it when you're done.
Yeah. So without naming names, of course, unless you absolutely want to, and somebody said you can name my name, can you give me an example of, you know, somebody like in this executive thing that has went through this and what happened to them, what changed them, and how they took all of what they learned in that and then implemented it into their business world?
Yeah. So they kind of come into categories, and so I'll get as specific as I can, but I've worked with an individual that really was having difficulty in terms of, is this, had a large, was a successful entrepreneur. Is this really what I want to do? I don't feel passion in this anymore. And so they were kind of in this big career transition inside themselves. I hadn't shared this with anyone else. And so plant medicine is one of those experiences that can give you insight in that type of way, as can horses, as can traditional coaching. It's one of the avenues that works. And so we did a week retreat within a 3-month coaching intensive. And that individual had a pretty profound experience where it was, you know, you can't unsee the things you see. And so came out the other side, oh my God, I have zero passion for doing this anymore. It's not on my radar. I've outgrown it. I've got no desire. And so that individual, you know, pretty freaked out, like, what do I do from here? And so worked with that individual over the course of the next couple months to, one, restructure their executive team. So promoted a new president and two new VPs to take over kind of the day-to-day ops, and then restructured the board so that this individual is now the board chair. So it took on an entirely different role that she was now just overseeing at a high level, but no day-to-day operations. And so that was a huge life-changing scenario that she had an inkling of early on, like, ugh, but was really attached to being the CEO, like had this identity of, I want to be a CEO. And through the experience, kind of ego got shattered a bit, but then found a way to kind of promote staff, create a different organization, basically the structure of the organization that allowed her to pursue an entirely different career while still nurturing this organization.
Now, Heather, did you write this book before or after you tried plant medicine? Because, you know, as we've discussed, it does bring about a change which you can't then really ignore, because once you're kind of back down to earth, you feel in some ways you've been living a lie, because things are revealed to you, you know, during that experience, and you have clarity for the first time in some areas, and then you have to go back to your regular life with this new realm of knowledge which you can automatically apply, because other people aren't necessarily always on the same page as you. So I was just curious, did you write this after you'd already had this insight, or was this a precursor to everything?
So the first edition was a precursor, and the second edition is now after plant medicine. So it shifted pretty dramatically in terms of, I was like, oh crap, the first one that I wrote is no longer what I believe. So I have to do some massive rework here. And so it was a daunting process to try to remap my thinking to what I now knew of myself and the world around me.
Now, so literally you took your own advice is what you're saying. I mean, you had the first edition of the book, right? And then you did that. And then now, you know, just like our copy here, second edition, right? You literally took your own advice and talk about that in the book, right?
Exactly.
So, you know, did you find that it changed your relationship with the horses? Because I know that, you know, obviously when you first see a horse, if you don't know anything about a horse, you see this big, powerful creature, which is stubborn, which can cause a lot of damage, maybe even kill you. But, you know, once you get to know a horse, you understand a little bit more about this is a gentle animal in a big body who truly kind of prospers and, you know, lives a better life once it has a deep relationship with you, with you, the rider and the trainer. And you know, people always speak to the gentle nature of horses. Did you find that after you took plant medicine that you understood the nature of the horse a lot more in terms of, you know, you have an animal with a lot of power which could, you know, basically tell humans to piss off, get off of my back, but they allow and actually seek out this kind of companionship with humans. I mean, they were decently easily domesticated compared to a lot of animals. But, you know, did you find that your relationship, even, you know, human to animal, completely changed?
With my dogs and my horses. So this is kind of a strange thing to reveal, but there are times that I'll microdose with psilocybin with horses. And again, a very small amount, but it shuts down that monkey mind, and I've got a crazy monkey mind. And when I can really kind of slow that down and be with horses, you understand horses in a whole different way. So horses are prey animals and we are predators. And so when you begin to understand that, that dynamic and how you can approach them differently, it translates so beautifully to how we approach humans as well. Because in some way, a boss is a predator and we as employees are prey animals. And so there's a really interesting kind of opening that happened for me in that space in terms of trying to understand how we relate to horses as it relates to leadership.
So how many horses do you have?
We've got three.
And their names. Come on, Nate. You know, we're going to talk about animals. You got to say what their names are and all that good stuff.
Yeah, we've got Andy and Maddie and Gabe.
Oh, okay,
good. Andy, Maddie, and Gabe.
Oh, I was just hoping there wasn't one named Tristan because you were going to say that was the special one that we got from the Humane Society that right. was a little lame yeah. And Nay's a little bit funny.
Unnecessarily aggressive.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, good. All right, we dodged a bullet there.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. So, overall, if you wanted to explain to somebody in 2 minutes, and the reason I'm asking you this question is because this is normally how long you'd have to present a revolutionary idea before everybody does just roll their eyes and walk out the room. How would you in 2 minutes explain your entire approach to this change in business without using any traditional buzzwords?
My goodness.
I feel like we should have a button over here that plays like the Jeopardy theme right now. It's like, you know, when now
going on for 2 minutes.
Though, is yeah, it? Exactly. Yeah. No, I think Jeopardy's yeah. only 30 seconds. Is it? But, yeah.
So how we do it or what we do?
Just everything. How do you explain this to somebody using no buzzwords whatsoever? Imagine that the entire room walks out the moment you use the buzzwords.
Have you even been paying attention to what I say, or do you just wait for your turn to speak? Because I asked her about the elevator speech thing, which was almost the same.
Yeah.
Not quite. Okay. How long have you got in an elevator? Maybe 5 seconds.
Depends on the elevator.
Yeah.
I mean, there are some elevators that are really slow, and the elevator could break down.
Yeah, I hope she's not going to base her business model on selling to people she's broken down within an elevator, because
that would be a bad idea.
Statistically, she's going to have to live to 528 years old before that instance occurs.
True.
Yeah. So go on, sell it. No buzzwords.
Let's see. You know, I would say that. I would just say that, you know, we work with, you know, high achieving entrepreneurs and executives to overcome some of their most persistent and stubborn roadblocks by using some of the most cutting edge modalities to, you know, upend the way we do things to create the life we most desire.
You see, I like that. I'd listen to that speech and be like, all right, I'm intrigued. But the moment, if you'd have thrown in a couple of like, normal traditional buzzwords that have been like, nah. So it's I like that.
I'm gonna work on it.
Yeah, no, I mean it's sincere, and it's a very interesting approach. It really is. And we'll be waiting for our invitation to come out, and so you can try to lie to her horses, because I don't think you can get away with it.
I can without the plant medicine. Once I'm on the plant medicine, that horse is gonna know everything I know.
I don't know.
I'm gonna give you a brownie, and then we're gonna go have some fun with the horses.
All right. Yeah. Ooh, that sounded dirty, but I shouldn't have said that.
She's in Colorado.
That's true. Yeah, it's not Alabama.
Yeah.
But anyway, well, Heather, great that you could join us today and take some time out of your day to explain all this. I mean, it's really fascinating. And of course, you know, it also goes to show there are more states in the union that have horses other than Texas and are using them for things. So that's fantastic. But can you let everybody know, first of all, how they can find the book, and then, of course, how they can find out more about you and the programs you offer?
Absolutely. So you can find the book on Amazon in hard copy and paper copy. The audiobook version is coming out in the next month. So if you're a huge audiobook fan, just wait a pinch for that.
Okay. Now let me interrupt you there. And yeah. I do not mean to sound like Joe Rogan here, but did you read the audiobook?
I did not.
Have you ever seen Joe Rogan gets very upset when people don't read their own books.
When they don't narrate their own books.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Did you consider doing that?
Yeah, I do not have the voice to narrate a book.
You should go to one of your like trainings, and you could get over the fact that you don't think you could read the book, because I think you could do it. So I will offer you that training class and take you for a ride on a horse and give you a mushroom. And next thing you know, you're going to read your own book. But sorry to interrupt, but
no worries.
Continue.
Social media, you can find me on LinkedIn as well as Instagram and Facebook, all the goodies. And you'll find that on our website, which is www.beontether.co. And one other thing that I would say for your listeners, we just have completed work on our assessment called the Growth Leader Index. So if any of your listeners have a desire to kind of get a bird's eye view on their ability to move through change, I'd be more than happy to provide a link that can go with the show notes, whatever, for your audience to jump in and take that.
Perfect. Sounds great to us. Yeah, please provide that link. We'll throw that in the show notes. And thanks once again, Heather, for joining us today on this episode of The Wolf and the Shepherd. That will do it for us today. But if you're watching this on YouTube, please click the logo in the corner and subscribe. It does help us out. Check Heather out. Heather, we certainly appreciate it. And we will catch you guys on the next one.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Wolf and the Shepherd podcast. If you like what you just heard, we hope you'll pass along our web address, thewolfandtheshepherd.com, to your friends and colleagues. And please leave us a positive review on iTunes when you get a chance. Check us out on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter for additional content. Join us next time for another episode of The Wolf and the Shepherd.